today, speaking to US journalist Lawrence Wright about his investigation into the way COVID-19 hammered America and what went wrong with the country's political response. In his months investigating America's response to COVID-19, there was one scene that New Yorker writer Lawrence Wright came back to. It was February 2020, and he was in Houston, Texas, sitting in a theatre, watching rehearsals for a play he himself had written.
The play was Camp David, about the Carter-Begin-Sadat summit in 1978. And the lighting was very interesting, you know, cross-lit, very low, slanted across the stage.
I guess you've been to a lot of peace conferences, you know what to expect.
And one of the actors, when he expostulated,
eternally at war?
You could see this cloud of saliva, like vapor in the cold.
To find a way to
peace. It lingered in the air, and I thought it was so dramatic.
And you keep closing the door to peace.
But later I realized that's exactly what a super spreader looks like.
Lawrence isn't the only one to look at the world in a slightly different way these days. For all of us, living through a pandemic has been kind of mind-altering. We look back at things that would have seemed so normal before and view them through this altered lens. That scene in the theatre wasn't actually a super spreader event. But while it was happening, America was already changing.
Are the words about a pandemic at this point?
No, we're not at all.
As we know, the impact of COVID was underestimated at the time.
It's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
But by then, by February, at least 10 people a day were already being infected in that state, in Texas.
As this coronavirus spreads, more than 160,000 cases in the United States.
And soon, COVID was spreading everywhere.
Most likely, you don't recognize what has happened to life in America in just a few short weeks.
A year on, America's COVID death toll stands at over 500,000. 2020 proved to be the country's deadliest ever year.
That's more Americans who have died in 1 year in this pandemic than in World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined.
And while it only makes up 4% of the world's population, the US now accounts for 20% of all COVID deaths. In a new book, Lawrence Wright goes deep inside Donald Trump's administration as the crisis unfolded to try to understand what went wrong. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the White House insiders who try to change America's response to COVID-19. Lawrence Wright, you're the author of The Plague Year, a devastating account of America and the Trump administration's failure to deal with the threat of coronavirus. But pandemics and viruses are far from a new interest for you. As a journalist, you've been reporting on them since the 1970s. And then early last year, you published a novel about a global outbreak of a deadly virus that emerges from Asia and a divisive, tanning bed-obsessed American president's inability to deal with it.
Yeah.
Some people call you Nostradamus and say you must have known something other people didn't.
Actually, I decided when I was in England to pick it up as a novel. I was trekking with my wife.
Now, from this cathedral city of calm dignity,
down the pilgrim's path,
start along the 150 miles of roadway and field path that lead to Canterbury.
Passing through some of the great cathedrals and churches, and we would have picnic lunches in the cemeteries sometimes. And I noticed this date that was so common in all the cemeteries, in all cemeteries in the world, 1918. And of course, Britain suffered terribly during that war, but the pandemic took more soldiers' lives alone than the war did. It reminds me of the iridium layer in the Earth's geology that marks the striking of the comet that killed the dinosaurs. It's a line through the cemeteries of the world. And I wanted to understand how a pandemic in modern day would affect our lives and try to make it into a novel.
And you've hit back at the idea that you were a clairvoyant, haven't you?
Yeah, I don't see myself as being clairvoyant or a prophet. You know, a reporter normally goes out and asks what happened. And a novelist would say what happened if. And for me, at least, the research required is very similar. Learning about the science, reading the tabletop exercises that are done, all the stuff that had been done to prepare for a pandemic, all those plans that were set aside and never paid any attention to when the actual pandemic occurred.
I love the idea that a reporter asks what happened and a novelist thinks, what if?
Yeah.
Okay, so that was fiction, but you're very much also in the business of facts. And I want to ask you about two figures who you focused on in this latest book, starting with Matt Pottinger, who was Donald Trump's deputy national security advisor.
Deputy national security advisor, Matt Pottinger, thank you for joining the show.
Roger, thanks for having me.
But he wasn't the typical Trump staffer, was he?
No, he's in a mixed marriage. In other words, his wife is a Democrat. And Matt, he's a fascinating young man.
You lived in China for some time, reporting for the Wall Street Journal. And then at the ripe age of 31 years old, I believe, you became a Marine.
Yeah, exactly. I needed more danger in my life, I guess.
He speaks fluent Mandarin.
大家早安,我是 Matt Pottinger.
He had been a Wall Street Journal reporter in China during SARS, the 2003 outbreak.
Chinese Foreign Minister Li Zhaoxin on Monday informed the foreign diplomats in China of the latest development of SARS and the key measures the Chinese government has taken.
And had witnessed the suppression of the news about that. I mean, when SARS broke out in China in 2003 and international health authorities went to examine it, Chinese authorities actually hid the patients in ambulances or taxis until the authorities were gone. I mean, the terrible damage that was done and could have been far worse than it turned out to be.
So what Pottinger had seen in that previous crisis was what made him realize how serious it would be this time.
Yeah. He began calling his sources in China, and he was learning things that were really shocking to him. The spread of the disease, how it was spread, all this stuff. And I appreciate this because here he is. He's got the CIA, he's got the NSC, he's got the FBI, and none of those other intelligence agencies had uncovered anything.
Wow, and he was right there in the middle of the White House. And yeah, he had these sources, so he knew what was happening. And he was one of the first advocates of a travel ban. How did that go down in the White House?
Oh, it was fiercely fought. Really, Matt Pottinger was alone in his advocacy for the most part. The economic advisors were horrified by the damage that might be done to the economy.
Is there any talk of closing flights from Europe or flights from Asia outside of
China? And the public health people like Dr. Fauci.
No, I don't think at all that that will happen. And that's
relied on the idea that, the virus can't be stopped by a travel ban.
It's become almost irrelevant because you can't keep out the entire world.
Many of the kind of verities of public health have been changed because of our current pandemic. But one was travel bans are useless.
But when you have multiple countries involved, it's very difficult to do that. In fact, it's impossible.
By the time you try to implement them, the virus has already slipped the nets. And so all you're doing is hindering the transportation of vital equipment and experts. And you can understand there is a case to be made. But on the other hand, a rapidly traveling, highly contagious virus, almost anything you can do to obstruct its spread is important. And so he was advocating for that in March, and it was a pitched battle.
After consulting with our top government health professionals,
but finally, Pottinger's point of view prevailed.
We will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days.
Trump later said he alone had come to that decision. Everybody was opposed.
Don't close off China. Don't ban China. And I did it anyway. I sort of.
But the truth is, the task force had pretty much been persuaded by Pottinger's arguments.
So they did do a travel ban, but one of the fatal flaws in America's handling of the pandemic was how slow it was to realize the importance of masks and how patchy Donald Trump's messaging was to encourage people to wear them.
There's a lot of confusion among people and misinformation surrounding face masks. Can you discuss that?
And even Fauci's wariness of them early doors.
Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks.
You're sure of it? Because people are listening really closely to this.
Right now, people should not be walking. There's no reason to be walking around with a mask.
But from your book, it sounds like Pottinger understood this from as early on as February and March last year and was desperately trying to get people in the White House to wear them.
There weren't even any masks in the White House. And Pottinger was calling doctors in China. And the information he was getting is, you know, social distancing, hand washing, those are important. What will really put the brakes on this virus is masks. Pottinger communicated with a source in Taiwan, and they were making millions of masks for their own population, but they set aside 500,000 to send to the White House. And Pottinger took about 5,000 of them for the White House staff and then put the rest in the National Storehouse.
Who wore them?
For the most part, Pottinger wore the mask alone for several weeks. I asked him, you know, when he first wore a mask, what was it like? And he said it was like walking into the White House wearing a clown nose. People were alarmed. People ridiculed him, looking at him strangely. And the president asked if he was sick. And he said, no, I just don't want to be the first person in history to knock off a president with a disease. Trump was actively sabotaging the whole idea. You know, they asked him to present the idea to the American people in April.
The CDC is advising the use of non-medical cloth face covering.
And, of course, what he said is,
I don't think I'm going to be doing it.
I'm not going to wear it.
Voluntary thing. You can do it. You don't have to do it.
But, you know, it might be good for you.
Some people may want to do it, and that's okay.
You know, he just continually undermined, sabotaged, in my opinion, the whole campaign. He even went to a mask-making factory without a mask. He began to conceive that people who wore masks were only doing so in protest against his presidency. And that was a very powerful motivator, I think.
Can you take it off because I cannot hear you?
I'll just speak louder, sir.
Oh, okay, because you want to be politically correct. Go ahead.
No, sir, I just want to wear the mask.
Go ahead.
And even in the coronavirus task force, there was a meeting in which mask wearing was endorsed officially by the administration. And then when Pottinger got back to his office, there was a memo announcing the date of the next meeting of the task force with an addendum saying no masks will be worn. It's just when he told me that, I still find it hard to believe.
So perhaps understandably, that memo was the final straw for Pottinger, who then stopped attending the task force meetings altogether. But clearly some of what he was saying was cutting through. Like with the travel ban you mentioned, which Trump announced to the nation on March the 11th last year.
My fellow Americans.
And as you write in the book, during that speech, he repackaged himself as a take charge president, a unifier, a consoler in chief.
With our allies, and we are marshaling the full power of the federal government and the private sector to protect the American people.
And then you write, if he had actually followed the course he outlined in the speech that night, the nation would have had a different experience. So what happened?
The federal government never took charge. The best example of this is during a call with the governors of the 50 states about getting personal protective equipment that's so badly needed and ventilators. The president said,
"So we are backing you in terms of...
We're behind you.
Getting what you need also, though."
But then he began to explain what he meant was,
"Try getting it yourself.
You get it. You know, we'll support your getting it."
Federal government's not supposed to be out there buying vast amounts of items and then shipping. You know, we're not a shipping clerk.
And, you know, the Gretchen Whitmer, who is the governor of Michigan, told me that she realized that they didn't have enough personal protective equipment for the next shift.
I need help out of the federal government. We all do. For the doctors and nurses that are wearing one mask for the whole shift.
And they were counting on the federal government to send masks and gloves and gowns and ventilators from the national stockpile, which was, nobody realized it in the States, so severely depleted that it wasn't going to be of any help.
We've gotten a few of our shipments out of the national stockpile, but the fact of the matter is the latest one had zero of these masks, and that's what is so crucial right now.
So the governors wound up trying to get the equipment themselves.
Well, unfortunately, the federal government really has delivered less than 10% of what we've asked for. So we've gone out onto the global market. I've got an entire team of people who have become supply chain experts.
And actually bidding against each other.
Against each other, where you now literally will have a company call you up and say, well, California just outbid you. It's like being on eBay with 50 other states bidding on a ventilator.
As the governor of New York said, it was like being on eBay.
Illinois bid, Florida bid, New York bids, California rebids. That's literally what we're doing. And then the federal government, FEMA starts.
We took very seriously the push that you made that we should not just rely on the stockpile and that we should go out and buy stuff
right.
And put in orders. And I got to tell you that on three big orders, we lost to the feds. I got a feeling that if somebody has a chance to sell to you or has a chance to sell to me, I'm going to lose every one of those.
it was chaos.
What sense does this make?
We have done a hell of a job. The federal government has really stepped up.
Well, what I'm asking is, what more specifically do you want the governor of Washington?
All I want them to do, very simple. I want them to be appreciative.
And the type of chaos you're talking about would land on the desk of the second White House insider I'm keen for us to talk about, Deborah Birx. She was actually appointed by Pottinger as the White House coronavirus response coordinator. And she seems to have taken that job knowing that it was maybe going to end badly.
She's in some ways kind of a martyr to this experience. She was the International AIDS Ambassador. PEPFAR is the name of the program that started under President George W. Bush, and it's been one of the most successful and the most concentrated effort to stop a disease in history, in large part because of Deborah Birx's efforts.
Yeah, but before PEPFAR started, there was a time when we were losing an entire generation in sub-Saharan Africa.
And she was then
families,
in South Africa,
children,
and,
mothers,
and
fathers,
she was
teachers,
called upon
doctors,
to come back to the United States and oversee the administration of the task force and try to make it effective.
In a time of hyper-partisanship and division over the American response to COVID-19, Dr. Birx is that rare breed of someone universally respected on both sides of the aisle, as well as by the medical community.
And she told me that, you know, when she got on the plane, she realized this would probably be the end of her career. And indeed, you know, there was one moment where the president, at a press briefing, offered the idea that bleach would be a good counter to COVID-19.
Injection.
We remember it well.
Because it works well, you know, on surfaces and maybe light.
So, supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's...
You know, ultraviolet light, you could get it into the body somehow.
And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it.
And here, somebody zoomed in on Deborah Birx, and you can see the expression on her face. And this is like...
And there was a meme that floated around the internet, her reaction.
It is funny and horrific. Here it is.
You know, she took a deep breath and squared her shoulders.
And it looks like she's having a panic.
You know, you can see her breathing heavily.
Literally, there's like an internal, therapist just saying... Breathe.
She looked like she might die of embarrassment.
Yeah. She did not stand up and say, that's crap, Mr. President. That's what everybody wanted her to say. But that wasn't what she was supposed to do. And indeed, she was pilloried.
Sure, it's not Dr. Birx, because I don't have confidence in anyone who stands there while the president says, swallow Lysol.
Even by many of her former colleagues, a former director of the CDC told me she was a disaster.
Somebody, when the president says it's a hoax, hoax. It's magic. It's going to go away by magic.
Her reputation is finished.
I think a large part of that was that they held her responsible for Trump's action because she was actually in the White House. But the problem wasn't so much that as other people were brought into the administration, like Scott Atlas, who became an influential health advisor.
Well, across the country, states are reporting higher numbers of COVID-19 cases. But should we be scared of that spread? Here to talk more about those numbers is Dr. Scott Atlas.
Who believe that the best thing is just to let the virus rage.
You look at those numbers, a lot of folks get scared. You get...
Well, I don't get scared when I do a more than superficial
and
analysis.
Burn itself out on the population.
What I do know is that the death rates are not going up, despite all the, you know, hand-wringing. That's what really counts.
So Birx eventually saw the writing on the wall, and she did something very entrepreneurial for a federal bureaucrat. She and her lead epidemiologist, Irum Zaidi, took to the road, and they went from state to state, covering 25,000 miles by car and some more by air, visiting governors, tribal chiefs, unions, schools, universities, telling them what needs to be done.
Dr. Birx arrives in Arkansas at the tail end of a 19-state listening tour, but she also came to deliver a message and also got her out of the white-hot spotlight in Washington.
And as NBC 10's out,
call Dr. Birx the mask messenger.
Sometimes scolding them in public if they failed.
Over the last 24 hours as we were here and we were in your grocery stores and in your restaurants and frankly even in your hotels, this is the least use of masks that we have seen in retail establishments of any place we have
been. And wasn't hesitant about mentioning to the press what needed to be done.
Tens of thousands of lives can be saved if we wear masks and we don't have parties in our backyard.
And she really made a difference. And I see that journey as being a commendable and almost unique effort by anybody in our government to try to bridge the spread of this horrible virus.
And do you call their road trip Thelma and Louise in the book?
Yeah.
But presumably with a different ending.
Well, exactly. But they reminded me, two very game women, you know, against all odds on this, I think, fabulous road trip. Irum, she loves to drive fast. And she actually trained at a raceway. She's really talented. But they went to Dallas to meet with the governor who was there. And Irum was stopped outside of Dallas going 110 miles an hour. But the state trooper let them go, which I can testify as a Texan is a rare act of clemency.
And what did those in the president's circle think of her approach?
You know, I think the people in the White House were glad she was gone. And I think they paid zero attention to what she was doing. You know, she had no supporters other than Matt Pottinger in the White House. Olivia Troy, who was on the vice president's staff, said they hated her. She just elicited this visceral reaction from Trump and Pence's staffs. But the people on the ground, they were grateful for, you know, the kind of instruction she was able to give them. She got results. And, you know, I think she saved many, many lives by her actions.
Coming up, was failing to listen to key insiders Donald Trump's biggest mistake? Lawrence, these two characters we've talked about, who you focused on in your book, Pottinger and Birx, clearly saw what was going wrong. And it sounds like they tried to say that out loud. They tried to do the right thing. And I know there were other people in a similar position. Is the way that Trump didn't listen to those voices really at the heart of what went wrong?
I do think that there were people that told the president the truth. I think he was unwilling and unable to take it in. His attitude towards the presidency in some ways was one of entitlement and also a kind of hobby. And that marked how the federal government approached the handling of the pandemic. The one thing I would give the Trump administration credit for is speeding the production of the vaccines. That was absolutely essential.
And yet, despite the vaccine, the death rate has been unbelievable. The tragedy has been unbelievable.
Yeah.
And do you think, looking back, that they think they did do the right thing? Was it worth it?
Well, you know, bear in mind the people that were closest to the president were ideologues, and very little shakes their belief in their ideology. Facts don't. So I doubt that they have changed their mind about anything. But if we've learned anything from this, we'll need to have an administration that actually takes on expert opinion and, you know, understands the limitations of experts. Leadership plays a role, but we need judicious leaders who can take the counsel of the scientists and, you know, the political advice and take the measure of the country and understand where it is and what kind of effects you can have. You know, those things are all qualities that you need to deal with a pandemic. But we did not have leadership. So I think in trying to sum up how we handled this particular contagion and how we might have to handle one in the future, you know, there has to be a kind of partnership between science and politics that we simply haven't had in this country and in many other countries around the world.
Lawrence Wright, thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
That was Lawrence Wright, staff writer at The New Yorker, playwright and author of several books, including his latest one, The Plague Year, which is out now. At the start, you heard extracts from Camp David play, courtesy of Lawrence Wright and the Alley Theatre, Houston, Texas. Thank you very much for that. Now, before we go, I've got a couple of things I want to mention. First, let me tell you about The Guardian's brilliant new interview podcast launching tomorrow. It's called Comfort Eating, and it is hosted by our very own restaurant critic, Grace Dent. She has a brilliant cast of famous guests round to sit down and eat their favourite comfort foods with her. Think chips and gravy, chicken kebabs, supermarket mac and cheese. It gives a hilarious insight into a side of celebrity we rarely get to see. As they eat, Grace and her guests talk about the most important moments in their lives and the comfort foods that have seen them through. It's very funny, but also really touching and revealing. As I said, it's released tomorrow, the 15th of June, and you can subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. Do also check out the latest Guardian documentary, Eve. It follows 9-year-old Eve on her journey back to mainstream schooling after moving to Tinker's Bubble, the oldest off-grid community in the UK. You can watch the film at theguardian.com/Eve and sign up for a new family-friendly event with Eve and the filmmakers in conversation with Guardian journalist Patrick Barkham. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Rose Dell'Arabiti. Sound design was by Sami El Anani. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.